You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the House has passed a resolution laying out the next steps in the impeachment investigation of President Trump. We'll look at what that means and the latest on the disputed phone call between Trump and the leader of Ukraine. Now, the separation of church and state has been a big part of American democracy since the country's founding, but the meaning of that idea and how to put it into practice has been controversial to the present day. Thomas Jefferson wrote about it to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802, stating, quote, "I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state," end quote. While the U.S. government never established a state religion, as many European countries did, the lines between church and state sometimes get blurry. Questions have come up lately on the issue about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's speech on Christian leadership, which was posted on the State Department website, and Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke saying religious organizations should lose their tax-free status if they discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Sarah Benish is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, we just heard that phrase, separation of church and state, and that quote from Thomas Jefferson. It's famously there. That line itself isn't in the Constitution, which a lot of people point out. Where did the importance of this idea, the separation between church and state, come from?
Well, I think it really comes from the reason that the founders came to the United States, or to what would become the United States in the first place, this idea that they wanted to get away from religious persecution. So it's really one of the main founding principles of the country. And so, you know, they were very committed to that, but that doesn't mean it's easy to define or easy to draw lines around.
Right. How often does this come up in the courts over American history? What exactly the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment means?
Oh, my goodness. There's a huge set of case law that the Supreme Court has gone through, and it's incredibly confusing and difficult to completely understand. I teach a course on it at UWM, and it's a fascinating course because we really walk away from the course knowing a lot and knowing nothing. You know, given the justices' proclivities and given the different interpretations of what that separation of church and state, what that wall is supposed to look like, you know, any given court is going to decide cases in a different way than its previous courts might have. So there's just so much going on in the discussion over what is an establishment of religion and to what degree does the government have to protect free exercise.
One thing that seemed pretty clear all along was that we weren't going to have something like the Church of England, which was a religious bureaucracy that was also at the same time part of the government. Everybody kind of agreed on that one, it seems like, right, Sarah?
Right, right. That's right. Although some of the colonies had sort of state religions established. So there's it's not completely clear that everyone was on the same page with that. And in fact, some of the framers were just mostly interested in protecting their own religion, right? And not all the other minority religions that might be there. But today, I think everyone would agree that if the United States were to somehow decide to declare itself a blank nation, Christian, Muslim, whatever, that would be beyond the pale.
Talking to Sarah Benish from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the separation of church and state and issues that come up to the present day. Let's get into one that put this in the news lately, Sarah. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to the American Association of Christian Counselors earlier this month. His speech and its posting on the State Department website in particular sparked some controversy. Here's a listen.
As believers, we draw on the wisdom of God to help us get it right, to be a force for good in the lives of human beings. Now, I know that even having just said that, I know some people in the media will break out the pitchforks when they hear that I ask God for direction in my work. But you should know, as much as I'd like to claim originality, it is not a new idea. I love this quote from President Lincoln. He said that he said, quote, "I have been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction I had nowhere else to go." And so with that in mind, I want to use my time today to think about what it means to be a Christian leader.
Now, there's nothing that controversial about about that? Is there, Sarah, a government official saying they're a Christian and speaking in public about how that that shapes their leadership? In this case, there's nothing that really violates the establishment of church and state in and of itself there, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we expect our leaders to have religious views. And in fact, there's some surveys that political sciences have done that suggests that a person who didn't have religious views would have a very difficult time gaining national office in our country. We have a very religious history. And so, you know, that is something, you know, there's religion all over our public ceremonies. And so that's not at all unexpected.
One thing that people have objected to more, though, is that this was posted on the State Department website earlier this month. So that use of a public government forum to promote this, does that get into grayer territory?
I think a little bit. I see why people were upset and why that was jarring to a lot of different groups who felt like that was the government saying that if they were not Christian, that they don't belong, or that the State Department is somehow promoting Christian leaders over other kinds of leaders. And the State Department took it down very quickly to its, you know, credit. And so I think, you know, we are very careful about where the line is. But like I said earlier, it's hard to draw the line. And so it's difficult to figure out when we're crossing over to a degree where we're actually talking about a violation of the Constitution.
Another thing that put this issue in the news, Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke got pushed back for comments he made at CNN's Equality Town Hall earlier this month. He made comments about religious organizations. Here's some what he said to Don Lemon, I think, asking the questions here.
This is from your LGBTQ plan, and here's what you write. This is a quote. Freedom of religion is a fundamental right, but it should not be used to discriminate. Do you think religious institutions like colleges, churches, charities, should they lose their tax-exempt status if they oppose same-sex marriage?
Yes. There can be no reward, no benefit, no tax break for anyone or any institution, any organization in America that denies the full human rights and the full civil rights of every single one of us. And so as president, we're going to make that a priority, and we are going to stop those who are infringing upon the human rights of our fellow Americans.
And that, Sarah, has raised concern. People saying, wait a minute, this is the president using the threat of, or a would-be president, raising the threat of using a church's tax-exempt status or other organization's tax-exempt status. Some people have said to punish them for a particular political viewpoint. What do you make of that back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting it's an interesting discussion, and it's especially interesting because his Democratic compatriots sort of backed away from him immediately upon hearing about that. So it's not a popular thing to talk about taxing churches, and that's a very clear violation of the separation of church and state as we have understood it historically, that, you know, once the state taxes an organization, then all of a sudden the state has something to say about the way the organization is run and the way they spend its money. And they have to report to the government what they're spending money on and how much money they're making. And all of those things make people very uncomfortable in terms of an excessive entanglement between the state and religion. So we have this historical assumption that churches are on their own because they're doing good work that the society values. And so, you know, we grant that tax exemption to make sure we maintain that separation. But there has been a lot of concern about what that tax exemption means to the endorsement of religion. So we give churches different treatment than we give other charitable organizations. And so some would argue that that actually preferences religion in a way that itself would violate establishment clause, which again is why I said these things are so complicated. But I think, you know, his immediate reaction to say, you know, yes, we're going to take that tax exemption away, he's already walked that back and really couched it as more about discrimination. And that's a completely different question that is also extremely relevant and timely right now.
Right. And that's those are things that have come up in court rulings over the Affordable Care Act and providing birth control and things, I think, like the Hobby Lobby case. Seems like the government, for the most part, has tried to be as hands off as it can with actual religious organizations, though, and letting religious organizations define what they are and just really trying not to nudge its way into those. Is that historically generally the trend?
Yes, that is true. Generally speaking, the government is not in the business of deciding which religions are real and which ones aren't, which religions are right, which ones are wrong, what sort of position a religion should take. So the idea that the government would have anything to say about whether or not a religion is in opposition to gay marriage, I think is pretty controversial in terms of the First Amendment. A closer question, I think, is it acceptable for a church-run school, for example, to fire a teacher because he is gay? And that, I think, was what Beto ends up coming back to saying, that that was what he was arguing, even though that isn't exactly what he said at the town hall.
Talking to Sarah Benish, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She's with us to talk about the separation of church and state and some recent political controversies and questions about that topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the separation of church and state in the United States? How do you think it should be implemented? What questions do you have? And in the news lately, is there anything that's striking you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the concept of separation of church and state and the role it plays in American politics. It's been in the headlines from the Secretary of State to a Democratic presidential candidate and more. Sarah Benish is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of the separation of church and state? How should lawmakers and politicians utilize that concept to keep church and state separate? Do you want to hear your lawmakers, your candidates talking about religion and how it informs their views? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hello. I need to ask a question about nonprofits. Okay, when the government gives nonprofit, let's say you're an apartment complex, but you're a nonprofit, they give them, you know, tax break. Why don't those buildings, those owners have to be energy efficient, have no smoking, hire the poor to do their lawns and the remodeling and the shoveling? Why doesn't the government have something to say about that?
I think a little off topic there, Mary Kay. We're mainly talking about religion and the government, but thanks for calling in. That's something we might check out in another conversation. So, Sarah, turning from that, I want to turn to comments now from William Barr, Attorney General, speaking at an address at the University of Notre Dame earlier this month. I'm going to quote a little bit of it. He said, "Secularists and their allies among the progressives have marshaled all the force of mass communications, popular culture, the entertainment industry, and academia in an unremitting assault on religion and traditional values." Now, here, people are a little worried about this. Again, this is a politician expressing their personal views at a public address. But people are looking at this saying, wait a minute, this is the Attorney General who will be making important legal decisions in the United States, expressing very strong viewpoints against a particular group of Americans. Does that bring us into some different territory?
I think that could get us into some different territory, sure. I think the ideas behind the separation of church and state apply equally to people who don't have religion as they do to people who do have religion. The idea is that the government shouldn't have anything to say about what you believe, and your place in the government shouldn't have anything to say about or shouldn't be driven by in any way what you believe. And so I think, you know, depending on what he means, I think this current administration is much more focused on religious discrimination, in that religious discrimination focus is much more closely placed on Christianity. And, you know, that can get into some issues of disproportionate treatment of different kinds of believers. And I think that could get into some constitutional issues.
Let's bring on a caller now. Roy is with us in Brandon. Roy, hi.
Hi. I was just listening, and a lot of times when I hear news reports about separation of church and state, I find myself a little confused, because as I was studying religion, as I was coming up as a teenager in religious classes, my understanding of the separation of church and state had to do and was based on the fact that we came out of England, where the church was state-sponsored and state-run. And basically, the king was the head of the religion, even though he claimed it was the bishops. And I always assumed that separation of church and state had to do with keeping the government out of establishment and backing religions, you know, throwing their weight behind any particular one religion, and not so much about keeping religion out of government.
Roy, thanks for the call. And it does cut both ways, right, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm sorry. My phone cut out a little bit, so I didn't hear all of Roy's question.
Okay. He was saying that his understanding... Actually, I think let's reconnect with Sarah. We'll try a different connection. We were doing great there, and it was kind of falling apart. We're talking to Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We're looking at the separation of church and state, where it came from in the... lead up to the U.S. Constitution and issues that it faces today, gray areas, points that come up in the courts and in American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there an issue at the national or state or even local level where you wonder how this works, how it all plays out, how it all fits into the law and the intent in the Constitution, where the line should be between religious expression and the U.S. government? We have Sarah back with us. So our caller, Roy, was saying, Sarah, he thought that, and we were talking about this a little earlier, coming out of England, the idea of the separation of church and state was meant just to make sure that the government wasn't interfering with religion. So it was meant to keep the state out of the church, not necessarily vice versa, he thought. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fair reading. I think the founders and the people of that time were very comfortable having religious aspects in government. You know, there are so many different religious ceremonies that are official ceremonies that are, you know, started with a prayer or ended with a prayer, or, you know, there are different functionalities of, you know, for example, the Congress has a chaplain. So I think the founders in that time frame, those people were very comfortable with having religious be a part of their lives and a part of their government. But yeah, they didn't want the government to decide which religion they needed to adhere to. And they didn't want that to be something that was government sponsored.
Thanks for that call, Roy. We'll go to Karen now in Hurdle. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm really frightened, frankly, by the erosion I see of the separation of church and state. But I'm wondering, how do we define church? You know, how do we define mega churches that are bringing in these vast amount of money? And is it really the church, or is it the lobbying arm of very extremist organizations that we're talking about when we discuss what is happening with not just being free to express religion, but free from other people's religion?
Karen, thanks for the call. Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Beto O'Rourke discussion sort of brings up that issue, and that's that, you know, some people would argue that these mega churches are not religious groups in the way that we expect them to be, in the way that the framers perhaps anticipated that they would be. And so the huge salaries that are being paid and the extravagant lifestyles are in some ways being seen as being subsidized through these tax deductions or these tax breaks or you know, the ban on property taxes religious buildings. And so I do think that makes it more difficult to understand what the relationship ought to be. But we also have to remember that the Supreme Court has been very careful about never imposing its own definition of religion or doing any kind of test for truth or anything beyond a real belief. So if someone has a true belief and it's not scientific and it's not political and it's not something else, then it can be deemed to be a religion. And so it gets really difficult if we want to try to start drawing lines between different groups and deciding what's a religion, what isn't.
Has it been a challenge for courts and policymakers as people of different religions start to be bigger and bigger factors in the U.S. population? Catholics at one point, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, Muslims in more recent years. Does this raise new questions about how church and state get along?
I think it makes everything a little bit more important. I think, you know, the separation of church and state becomes all the more necessary when we have all different kinds of people believing all different kinds of things, and there are no longer any sort of marginalized tiny little groups of religions. Because generally speaking, when we have an issue with religion, it's the majority imposing its will over a minority religion. And so, you know, as we get more religions, it makes the landscape, I think, a little bit more complicated. But I think that idea that Karen raised about being free from religion is important, too, because, again, as I said earlier, not being religious is also a group, right? And so we want our government to treat all of those groups equally and to be equally available to all of those kinds of groups. And that gets difficult when we have, you know, lots and lots of different groups.
I've heard the argument from both sides over the years in various church and state disputes that it could be a slippery slope, that this one decision here is a step toward either further erosion of religious rights or further incursion of religion into government. Is there really a slippery slope, or is it just like lots of gray area that we're trying to sort out all the time, Sarah?
Yeah, I think there is just a ton of gray area. You know, so the court has used all different kinds of tests to decide when a given government action violates the First Amendment. And the court itself doesn't agree among the members or over time on what that test is. So the court has talked about, you know, that laws need to have a secular purpose and that they can't inhibit or promote religion. And then later the court says, well, all we need to worry about is that the government can't endorse religion. And then later the court says, well, as long as the government doesn't coerce people into religious exercise. And so I think I'm not sure about slippery slopes. I think, you know, there's ebbs and flows. And I think sometimes the Supreme Court is more protective of religion. Sometimes the Supreme Court is less protective of religious groups, more protective of those not espousing a religion. And, you know, probably nobody's ever happy with the balance that we're striking.
It's a good place to leave it with all of us unhappy. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. I'm happy to come and, you know, rain on your parade.
That's Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She joins us today to talk about the role of the separation of church and state in national politics and our understanding of democracy and some recent public comments by elected officials and candidates that have raised new issues. Coming up, we'll get caught up on the House's vote today to formalize the impeachment inquiry of President Trump and look at the latest in testimony about Ukraine. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of a new book about the Standing Rock pipeline protests and the movement that's grown around them. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. House this morning passed a resolution laying out the next steps in the impeachment process of President Trump.
On this vote, the yeas are 232. The nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
No Republicans voted for the resolution. Two Democrats voted against it. The move gives House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff the power to conduct open hearings and lets President Trump and his lawyers cross-examine witnesses. After the vote, Trump tweeted, quote, "the greatest witch hunt in American history." Meanwhile, more witnesses are testifying behind closed doors about whether Trump improperly pressured Ukraine to conduct investigations that would benefit him politically. Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He teaches courses on constitutional law. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Also with us, Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the Marquette University Political Science Department. He's an expert on post-communist politics, including Ukraine. Lowell, good to have you back, too.
Great to be back, Rob.
Charlie, let's start with you. What does this process look like now under this vote from the House today?
It looks very similar to what we saw during the Nixon impeachment process as well as the Clinton process. You know, what in both of those, there had been a lot of preliminary work done either by the Senate or by a special prosecutor. So there wasn't very much for the House to do. The House is grinding through some of that work right now, hence some of these more secretive committee hearings. But in essence, the same kind of process that's going to allow for the dissemination of the transcripts from those committee hearings will be available once they wrap up those investigations. Then we're going to have open hearings that will allow for Republicans to take a larger role in the process. And you're going to see the president's lawyers be able to inject themselves into the process as well. So what we're seeing really is a repetition of what the House has tried to do in the few modern impeachment processes that we've seen.
Charlie, Republicans have objected to the closed-door meetings where a lot of this testimony has come before three committees, the Democratic and Republican members there. And even with this vote, they say that start taints the whole process. What do you make of that criticism?
You know, it's interesting because this process, the impeachment removal process that the Constitution provides, it kind of replicates what we see in the private sector, where a grand jury will be impaneled to determine whether or not an indictment should be issued for an individual. And those are conducted in secret, in part because we want to protect individuals who may be under suspicion for a crime. And so we sort of protect them from any invasion of privacy and those kinds of issues in case they aren't indicted. And in many respects, that's what's going on here, trying to protect the process and trying to ensure that those who are testifying, as well as those who might be under suspicion, don't have to face that kind of public scrutiny early. As soon as they feel comfortable with the fact that they're going to go to an open forum, all of this information is likely to be made available to the public. So it's hard to act in some untoward fashion when you know it's going to be projected to the public soon. Obviously, we'd like an open process, but there are reasons to keep a closed door here before they expose it to complete public view.
I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking here before today's vote.
This is a sad day. It's a sad day because nobody comes to Congress to impeach a president of the United States. No one. We come here to do the work, make the future better for our children, for America's future. We take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and that's what we cannot ignore, and we will not ignore when the president's behavior indicates that investigation, that inquiry is necessary.
And Lowell, that behavior she just referred to involves the president's interactions mainly with Ukraine and the leadership of that country. What are some of the key points of what we've seen from the president publicly and in the testimony that we've heard about?
Well, I was just thinking today that really the investigation's only gone now for about 3 weeks and has uncovered quite a bit. And I think that as I was kind of thinking about the key actors in this so far, obviously, we need to not forget the whistleblower. I mean, this is the most important person in that we're not here right now if it were not for that complaint that was filed. I think there's some interesting things that people have corroborated each other's testimony in a lot of ways from what we've heard from people in general ways afterwards and what we've seen in their released opening statements. But there's also different things that each one of them brought. I thought Maria Ivanovich's testimony was actually quite important, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine who was removed. And one of the things about that was to kind of show this wasn't a whim. This wasn't just a phone call. This was a really long thought out and kind of process of actions involving Ukraine to enable Rudy Giuliani and others to work to kind of put pressure on the Ukrainian government. I think Fiona Hill is sort of a sneaky important testimony. She was the former Russia expert on the National Security Council because she was one that really brought up John Bolton, and I think he's going to be a very interesting figure down the road. I think Gordon Sondland was important for the Republicans. I think he made an argument that, yes, this maybe wasn't the greatest thing to happen, but he did not think there was any kind of quid pro quo, and the president told him there wasn't. I think, though, the two people testifying over the last week, Bill Taylor, who testified on the 22nd, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who'd been back at the request of Mike Pompeo to go back to Ukraine. I mean, his testimony is really a turning point. I think it from what we've heard from people, again, with reporting on what went on behind closed doors, which you have to, take with a grain of salt, but that this was a turning point, and even Republicans in the room realized this is not a good set of facts that are coming out for the president. And then I think Alexander Vindman was really important the other day on October 29th. The Army Lieutenant Colonel, he's a decorated war veteran. You know, he comes to testify under oath in his dress uniform. And I think that one of the things about that was that not only really important in how he corroborated other things, but just the kind of questioning of his patriotism, I think, was too much for some people even on the right. And you saw some people actually kind of defending him against criticism. So I think that's another one of the important sort of moments recently.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College with the latest on the impeachment inquiry. Big vote today in the House, moving it forward to a public stage. I want to give a listen to Republican Jim Jordan, ranking Republican on the House Oversight and Reform Committee. He also, like Pelosi, called today sad. Here he is after the vote saying the president didn't do anything wrong.
There is no conditions in the transcript. There's no quid pro quo in the transcript. Even the day after the call came out, Democratic chairmen were saying, well, there's no quid pro quo there, but we're going to keep on doing what they've been putting our country through. Second, the two individuals on the call both have said, President Trump, President Zelensky, have both said there was no pressure, no pushing, nothing. Third, the Ukrainians didn't know aid had been held up at the time of the phone call. And fourth and most important, what action did they take? What action did President Zelensky take or the Ukrainians take to ever free up the aid that was held up? They did nothing. No statement, no announcement of any type of event. Those facts have never changed, will never change, but they don't care.
Lowell, is it that black and white?
Well, there's a lot that he just said there. I think the idea that it's sort of just a phone call and nothing on the phone call was a problem is not the strongest argument, because again, this isn't just about the phone call. The phone call put things into initial relief, but there is a lot of evidence that has come out behind closed doors that I suspect when we see those transcripts from the depositions, we will see, in fact, that there was a lot of information about things beyond a phone call. I think that, I do want to say that there's a Republican argument here that we have to take really seriously, and it is that, you know, maybe the president shouldn't have done this the way he did, but it just doesn't rise to the level of impeachment and removal. And I personally disagree with that. I think it is an abuse of power for personal political gain. I don't think you have to have the other side being aware that all the pieces had fallen into place for it to be something we would not want a president to do for our sake, of our reputation, of our country, and our national security. If I rob someone's house, I've committed a crime if they, you know, haven't figured out yet that I've stolen something. I mean, the issue is not so much that Ukraine knew or didn't know at a certain point or what they did. It was the effort to get them to do this that's the problem. And I think that's something that we need to keep in mind going forward.
And Charlie, what are you watching for now as this public process goes forward and Democrats move to presumably draft articles of impeachment?
I'm going to agree with Professor Barrington, because part of this, I think, that's going on is that the Republicans are trying to find an argument, and they had latched on to process. Well, now the process is going to be more favorable towards President Trump as well as the Republicans in the way in which they can engage. And so they've lost that argument, and now they have to really grapple with the substantive issues. So what we're, I think, going to see is an argument about, as exactly Professor Barrington is suggesting, what is an impeachable offense? So it's going to get down to a more granular level about, does this actually count? And it's difficult, because in contemporary politics, I think we reflect on impeachment and removal as a very criminal type of process. But, you know, Alexander Hamilton wrote right at the founding that really the kind of offenses that we're thinking about is the misconduct of public men. That's how he wrote it. This idea that we violated the public trust, and that's what the president or the vice president or any other impeachable official has done. And that's actually a rather low bar, but it's a political bar. And so what we're going to have to look for is how we're going to frame this debate about whether or not this conduct and how it's been portrayed by witnesses as well as the transcript, whether or not that rises to the level of that bar, and whether or not we can lower it from that argument we have about criminal activity that might be involved here.
We're talking about today's vote by the U.S. House to formalize the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Lowell Barrington and Charlie Jacobs are with us from Marquette University and St. Norbert College, respectively. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the House voting to begin a public stage of this impeachment inquiry process? Are you glad Democrats are pressing ahead with it, or do you think they should drop it? What questions do you have for our guests about President Trump's phone call and the buildup to that, the relationship with Ukraine, the whistleblower, the impeachment proceedings? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about today's vote by the U.S. House to lay out the next steps in the impeachment investigation into President Trump. Charlie Jacobs is with us from St. Norbert College, Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, and questions on impeachment. 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my question for your guests would be the following. You know, during the Obama administration, Lois Lerner obviously did something maybe not perfect in her affecting the civil rights of a rival political party. And I look at the person today who testified in the meetings and said he was in on the phone call, and yet he didn't think anything illegal happened. Aren't we really kind of dealing with an ambiguous area in that while these the impeachment inquiry should continue, it should be fair to both sides and then really get down to narrowing what is allowed and not allowed by our chief executive?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Charlie Jacobs?
I mean, it's a good point, because what we have to recognize is, as I just mentioned, this is a political process. It's not a legal process. And so we have to rely on the members of Congress to evaluate for us what they believe is an impeachable offense. And the recourse that we have as citizens is if we perceive that the House of Representatives is conducting an unfair investigation, is not providing due process for the president, and is in essence railroading the executive, then we turn to the polls and we can throw those people out of office and replace them with those who are going to treat the president with more fairness and more equity. So that's the process. Unfortunately, only through public opinion polls and our reaching out to our representatives can we maybe influence them in the way they're going to behave. Once this horse is out of the barn, they're probably going to pursue it as far as they go, and they have to make a decision about any action by an individual within the executive branch about whether or not their activities are appropriate or inappropriate and rise to the level where we have to proceed in this manner.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. We'll go to Gene now in Richland Center. Gene, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question, kind of comment, is with Joe Biden, you have him on video kind of bragging in a way about while he was vice president, getting rid of, or, you know, pressing Ukraine to get rid of someone that was against him, or not necessarily him, but what his son was involved with and everything. So how is it okay for him to do it and then Trump not to do? Why is there a double standard here?
Gene, thanks a lot for the call. He's talking about the prosecutor in Ukraine, who I believe the concern was that he wasn't pursuing corruption cases enough. Lowell, let's bring you in on this one.
Yeah, and I appreciate the caller's comment, and I think both the callers so far, it's nice to have people kind of come in with some facts and questions, and I think that's great. The situation with what Joe Biden was talking about is we actually are now on our sort of third Ukrainian prosecutor general since the initial conversations about what Joe Biden had been talking about back then. But the one that he was commenting on, Viktor Shokin, was someone, as you said, Rob, that actually was ousted in 2016, partly because of pressure from the U.S., but there was pressure on Ukraine from all over the world, including a lot of Europe, on Poroshenko, the president at the time, to fire Shokin. And it was, you're right, precisely because he was not prosecuting instances of corruption by political elites in the country. And in fact, I think that, you know, the thing that Biden was talking about there is, you know, we were really working on corruption as in a general way. I think linking it to this case, therefore, is a little awkward, although I think it's fair to say, you know, we were certainly influencing domestic things in Ukraine there and putting pressure on them to do that. So isn't that the same thing? The key difference is the difference between what kind of corruption people were worried about. If the administration had a track record over the last couple of years of really working on the issue of corruption around the world, and even in a country like Ukraine, really pushing them in general on political and economic corruption at high levels across different parts of the Ukrainian government where there is plenty of corruption. If that had been the focus, I think the link would be a little more reasonable, but that's not been the focus. There was really two specific things that they've asked to be investigated. One is this sort of conspiracy theory about Ukraine's involvement in the 2016 election, which would then lessen the impact somewhat, I guess, in people's minds about Russia's impact on the 2016 election. And the second is the, you know, examination of the particular company that Hunter Biden was involved in, Burisma, which again is being chosen specifically because that then creates a kind of taint for Joe Biden. So it's, I think it's fair to bring it up. I don't see them really as anything close to equal situations, though.
Gene, thanks for that call. We're talking about impeachment and Ukrainian news and the testimony that's been coming out. We've got Lowell Barrington from Marquette University and Charlie Jacobs with us. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hello.
Hi, I just want to share a story. In August of 1974, I was a political page for Senator Edward W. Brooks of Massachusetts. And it was a really different political time because there were these things called liberal Republicans and these things called conservative Democrats. And I feel today we've parked ourselves into such corners that Donald Trump has succeeded in almost creating a political nihilism where facts don't matter. I'd be interested in your guest commentary on that.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's throw that one to you, Charlie. And that polarization and partisanship came before Donald Trump was even running for president, right?
Yeah, but you know, Jim raises a really interesting point. If you look back at the Nixon impeachment vote, it was 410-4. If you look at Clinton's vote, it was 258-176, and there were 31 Democrats who voted for impeachment. And, you know, we still had some Southern Democrats hanging on, just as Jim suggested, who were typically more conservative than most of their colleagues on the left side of the aisle. You know, the Trump vote here was 232-196. Two D's voted no, and there was unanimity in voting no from the Republican Party. So we really have seen that political division ideologically. Now, whether or not Trump himself is sort of the causal factor for this kind of division, polarization has been creeping ever larger over the last decade or so. So he just may be one of the many results of this division that we've seen nationwide over time. But certainly we're seeing it encapsulated in this event. And I think Jim's insights are really valuable.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that firsthand perspective on Watergate. Just a couple minutes left now. Lowell, I want to hear what you are watching for next when it comes to what we know and don't know about Ukraine, President Trump, and the various intermediaries there.
Well, I think on the Ukrainian side, I think there's a lot of people in the U.S. thinking or hoping that we're going to hear from Ukrainian officials. That seems pretty unlikely. The president has really avoided answering questions. He's been getting asked from reporters about what he thinks about what's going on in the United States right now. And the foreign minister made a pretty strong statement yesterday, I think, about, you know, yes, they'll show up if they're really summoned to go and testify, but they really don't want to interfere in what they see as a kind of domestic U.S. incident. In terms of who's up next, I mean, this is the really fascinating part of, you know, what Professor Jacobs had talked about the switch to this more public process, because some of these people might still be testifying behind closed doors first and then be brought up publicly. But there's going to be some big fights to even get them there. And that's, you know, Mick Mulvaney, that's Rick Perry. Certainly John Bolton has already been subpoenaed to testify. And then, you know, the interesting scenario of Rudy Giuliani under oath for everyone to watch would be a spectacle probably for the history books.
And Charlie, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching the polls because, you know, we saw a dramatic shift once the Ukrainian issues became much more public and gained traction among the media. I mean, we've seen a 12-point shift in independent support for impeachment. We've seen a 12-point shift for Democrats, a slight 1.5% or so Republican shift. But I think that the Democrats felt free in their vote today because of this kind of public support. It'll be interesting to see, as Professor Barrington notes, when this becomes public, does it maintain that traction with the public? Are they convinced more, less? What are they going to do when they hear the information firsthand?
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lowell, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor and Chair of the Marquette University Political Science Department. We talked with them about the impeachment process against President Trump, a big vote taken today in the U.S. House to advance that process and kick off a new stage that will include now public hearings and testimony, plus the latest on President Trump, his disputed phone call to Ukraine's president, and the efforts of Rudy Giuliani. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Twitter says they're not going to sell political ads anymore, while Facebook is getting criticism for not fact-checking campaign advertising on their site. We'll explore the frontiers of politics and social media. Communities around Wisconsin have been hit with heavy rains in recent years that overwhelm their local infrastructure. A Wisconsin engineer tells us how changing weather is making it harder to deal with flooding around the state. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, or is it Food Pie Day? Because we're going to talk about pies with America's Test Kitchen, so you know they're going to have some really good pie recipes that are probably going to work, even when I try them. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.